Sunrise will be at around 6:10. Sunset at 8:10. The weather looks to be fine spring weather, with temperatures rising to 19 to 20 degrees Celsius.
Welcome to the Samwell News for April the 12th. Our last before our Easter break, but more about that in a moment. In the meantime, some of the things coming up.
Wednesday's news. Warning about danger of halogen heaters. April Fool's pranksters. Were you caught out? Thursday's news. Sedley Bike and Toy Shop to close after 160 years in business. New machine at work on pothole-ridden roads. Friday. Tipton Slasher Heritage Trail set to be a knockout. Post Office confirms service is shutting down in Great Bar. Saturday's news. Two found guilty in murder trial. Partially sighted artist's exhibition amazes visitors. Monday's news. Polish bakery tantalizes the taste buds. School with links to City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. In the final day's news for Tuesday, royal recognition given to voluntary groups.
Those stories and more coming up in this edition, courtesy of Express and Star Papers. And I said a moment ago, this will be a break for the talking news for 2 weeks, if not 3 weeks. Our next edition will be coming to you on May the 3rd, because we're taking a break for Easter because of the bank holidays. And not just because we want a rest, but also because our readers and all the people involved have other things in life they have to do. So it's not practical to get an edition to you before then. Sorry about that, but hope you can live without us for the next 2 or 3 weeks. There are no scaffolding and road reports to bring you this week, but instead I must tell you about the upcoming annual general meeting of Samwell Talking News, which will be held on May the 12th. Now, a letter is going out to people and may already have been sent out, but here's a reading of the letter and a word from our speaker this year, who looks to be a very interesting guy.
9th of April 2025. Dear Samwell Talking News listeners, Samwell Visually Impaired members, volunteers and friends. Samwell Talking News Annual General Meeting at West Bromwich Town Hall on Monday the 12th of May 2025 from 12:30pm to 2:30pm. You are warmly invited to join us for our STN Annual General Meeting. As well as conducting the formal business section of the meeting, we will welcome our guest speaker, Frank Caldwell. We met Frank at the Oak House last December when he gave us an entertaining account of how Christmas was celebrated at the house in its heyday, in our Christmas special. We enjoyed his interesting talk so much we invited him to speak at our AGM. We always welcome new committee members to help run and support our Talking News. If you or someone you know would like a position on the Samwell Talking News Committee, please contact us via Samwell Visually Impaired. Please note, minutes and financial reports are available upon request. Please contact the SVI office if you wish to attend the AGM by calling 0121 525 4810 or email info@samwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk. Our editor, Ray, will put some of the highlights of the AGM in the Talking News editions following the meeting. So if you cannot attend on the day, you can still listen to some of it later. We look forward to welcoming you. With thanks and best wishes, Tony Averis, Chair, Samwell Talking News. The programme. Date and time, Monday the 12th of May 2025, 12:30pm to 2pm. 12:30pm registration, 12:45pm welcome from Tony Averis, STN Chair. 1pm guest speaker, Frank Caldwell. 1:30pm break. 1:45pm 2024 AGM minutes. 1:50pm financial report, including our thanks to our funders. 2pm election of committee. 2:15pm listener and volunteer comments and feedback. 2:25pm closing remarks and thanks. Please register at the SVI offices from 12:30 p.m. Access to the office is at the rear of the Town Hall building. Ring the buzzer for SVI and a member of SVI staff will direct you to the meeting.
Hello, my name's Frank Caldwell and I will be the guest speaker at your AGM on Monday the 12th of May. I'll be talking about the history of Sandwell Priory and some of the buildings in Sandwell Valley. I don't think it will be a dry talk. It will encompass gold smuggling, arms dealing, false imprisonment, prison breaks, and some very, very naughty monks. If any of that seems interesting to you, and I'll range over a wide area of activity, then please come along. I promise I'm not making any of it up. It's all true. Even probably the first known instance of a file being smuggled into a prison in a fruitcake. I worked for Sandwell Council for 20 years and spent over 40 years in the museums business, principally restoring historic buildings and historic ships for the purpose of making them visitor attractions. I retired about 18 months ago and am now spending a lot of my free time researching deeper into West Bromwich history, things I couldn't do with all the bureaucracy that local authorities require its museums managers to do, and also trying to put together a full catalogue of black country produced stained glass in the 19th and early 20th century. I hope the history of Sandwell Priory interests you. I'm sure you'll find out things you didn't know, and it will put a new perspective on Sandwell Valley the next time you go for a visit. I hope you'll be able to make it to the talk. Thank you very much. See you on Monday.
Thanks, Frank, and look forward to seeing you. And I think I might have met you at least once before when we had a tour of West Bromwich Hall near the Walsall Road. I hope we'll see you there. And do let us know if you're coming as soon as you can, maybe just after Easter or early May. Now, you've heard some of the things coming up in the headlines. We've not one but two reports of West Bromwich Albion's matches. Not good news, I'm afraid, for supporters. But we do bring you the latest news, whether it's good or bad. And a few more items along the way, as usual, including the TV and radio listings and one or two other items. So it's the first day's news then from James.
This is James Brodie bringing to you stories from the Express and Star dated the 2nd of April. Warning issued after fatal blaze cause confirmed. Investigators have confirmed a house fire in Tipton which killed a 79-year-old man and his dog started accidentally. They've issued a warning to people about not placing items close to halogen heaters as this was found to be the cause of the fire. The man's body was found inside the house in Elizabeth Walk after the fire, which was reported at 6:20 a.m. on Sunday. Around 50 firefighters attended to get the blaze under control. A statement from West Midlands Fire Service said, "Our thoughts remain with everyone affected. Our fire investigators have confirmed that the fire started accidentally involving items placed close to a halogen heater. Please help us prevent such tragedies by taking a moment to read and share these key safety tips about using portable heaters. Don't place heaters where they block escape routes or where they can be easily knocked over. Switch off, unplug and let heaters fully cool before moving them and only use heaters in rooms they were designed for. Never use them in bathrooms or bedrooms and always ensure heaters are not placed near flammable materials such as furniture, curtains and bedding. Buy from recognised manufacturers and retailers and register your product in case of recalls." PM, courage of bereaved families is just remarkable. This story is brought to you by Christine Dyer. Supporting this article is a picture of Keir Starmer talking to two people with the caption, "Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer praised hard-hitting campaigns by local newspapers." Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer has praised the courage of bereaved parents for speaking out on knife crime. He also thanked local newspapers like the Express and Star for campaigning on the issue. Sir Keir Starmer spoke on Downing Street reception for regional newspapers, attended by the Express and Star editor Mark Drew and its special correspondent Mark Andrews. The Prime Minister spoke of the importance of a local press and made a point of highlighting knife crime as the issue where it's made a difference. He praised the unbelievable bravery of parents like Pooja Kanda, whose 16-year-old son Ronan was killed in a case of mistaken identity. His teenage attackers struck him from behind as he walked home in Wolverhampton using a zombie knife and a ninja sword they had bought on the internet in the attack. Ms. Kanda and her family have campaigned tirelessly for new laws to crack down on the sale of those weapons backed by the Express and Star. New legislation, dubbed Ronan's Law, will now come into the summer and will make it illegal to sell zombie knives and will also close a loophole that prevented ninja swords from sales online. Sakir said the issue of knife crime had been highlighted incredibly powerfully by the local publishers like the Express and Star, which he said are based on the communities where the impact is most felt. He said running campaigns has always been an important part of regional media. They are often on things like knife crime, which get picked up at the local level, very often with grieving families who quite remarkably turn their grief into something more positive for other people. I've always been humbled by meeting parents of children who have been tragically killed. The fact that they're able to pick themselves up and run a campaign is incredible, and the local press are able to amplify that message. People see the local regional media as a trusted source in a way that they don't quite believe they can get elsewhere. I think it makes it really important. It is also important that newspapers keep holding us to account. The local press should keep advocating for your regions, because obviously here in Downing Street is where we have a laser focus on communities that you're advocating for delivering in other priorities, and you must hold us to account for that. Ms. Kanda was in London this week to meet ministers as the new Ronan's Law prepares to come into force. Ms. Kanda has also appeared in actor Idris Elba's BBC documentary Our Knife Crime Crisis, which said every time she is aware of another stabbing case, her heart was broken over and over. She said it's very hard to continue to live in a positive way when you're continually seeing knife violence growing amongst these children. Decisions and lessons for baggies under 21s. This story is brought to you by Lewis Cox. Supporting this article is a picture of the West Bromwich Albion player Issosa Sewell celebrating his first goal against QPR. The picture is by Gareth Evans. Albion under-21s exited the Premier League Cup with a 3-2 defeat to Queen's Park Rangers at their Solihull Moors home. Two goals from striker Issosa Sule was not enough for the junior Baggies, which led 1-0 and trailed 2-1 as QPR came on stronger later in the second half to secure progression. We caught up with under-21s boss Richard Beale afterwards to discuss the defeat. In the latest under-21s notebook are some of his thoughts and other observations from the clash. Mix Knight for goalscorer. Former Celtic striker Sully turned 19 on Tuesday. His double might have been the perfect pre-birthday present, but for the tie's disappointing outcome. The pacey frontman, who joined Albion from the Hoops early in 2023 and is out of contract this summer, was a thorn in QPR's backline all evening. His speed and movement caused all manner of problems and were key to his well-taken goals. But it could have been a better night for the Scot personally as well as for Albion. Sully had another two 1v1s saved by Busy R's goalkeeper Nathan Shepherd, who guessed right on both occasions. His overall threat, though, will have impressed coaching staff. He showed good strength to bundle a defender away for his second. Decision time on futures. Most of those playing for Albion against QPR had learned about their futures at the club in advance. Albion Academy manager Richard Stevens and other youth staff delivered the news to youngsters in recent weeks. A handful of the under-21s have existing deals running next season and beyond. Beale said those meetings are horrible, not nice, but it's really nice when you're giving the good news. Two goals from our striker Sian Dillon either side of the Emerson Sutton tap-in earned the visitors progression in a clash. QPR initially trailed 1-0 before fighting back. Bulls behind defences caused havoc all night, and QPR's first and second goals both came from simple finishes from a delivery flashed across from the right. The lads did really well to get to this stage, but I felt we didn't perform like we can do, which is disappointing for everybody concerned, Bill said. That being said, we created enough chances to win. I didn't take them and defended poorly for the goal. You get your just rewards in football, and we didn't deserve to win. Albion attackers Ollie Bostock and Akil Higgins missed out with minor injuries, with midfielder Cole Deeming also sidelined. Striker Leon Love is yet to return from a lengthy setback. Beale's sides have three league fixtures remaining in PL2, beginning at Leicester next Monday before a home Solihull face-off with Arsenal on April 14th and a closing trip to Middlesbrough 4 days later. The junior Baggies are currently 18th in a division of 26 teams. The top 16 qualify for the end of the season playoffs, as well as playing next season's International Cup, which is group stage competition involving ties against European opponents. It'd be brilliant for West Brom to play against European opposition, added Beale. Young lifeguards pull out stops in Championship debut. This story is brought to you by Greg Rees. Supporting this article is a picture of the 8 lifeguards in bright yellow t-shirts with the word Sandwell in red across the fronts. A team of 8 junior lifeguards from Tipton Leisure Centre have done the region proud by competing in the National Speed Lifesaving Championships. Officially called Speed 25, it's the largest competition of its kind in the country and sees more than 500 life-saving athletes aged 12 and above from across the UK and Ireland competing for national titles in what is the only sport that has a humanitarian foundation. The competition took place at the renowned Sandwell Aquatic Centre in Smethwick on Sunday the 30th of March. The Sandwell youngsters, 4 boys and 4 girls, all aged between 12 to 14, were up against 33 other clubs from across the UK, and in the 4x25 mannequin carry relay, both teams displayed an impressive skills, coming in 7th girls and 8th boys. In the 4x50m medley relay event, where the Finns and Torpedo boys were utilised to tow teammates back to the finish line, the boys' team showed incredible perseverance and came in 5th place in their race. Overall, the boys finished 8th nationally in the 12-14-year-old age group, which is a remarkable achievement considering it's the first time a team from Sandwell has entered. Mitchell Davis, swimming coordinator at Tipton Leisure Centre, said, "All the children have truly outdone themselves in this recent National Speed Lifesaving Championship, and I couldn't be more proud of them. They participated in 3 tough events, showcasing their strength, agility and teamwork, and demonstrated exceptional skills and determination throughout the competition. Their achievements are a testament to their hard work and dedication." April Fools 2025, did these West Midlands pranksters get you? Supporting this article is a picture of an ambulance with a caption underneath saying West Midlands Ambulance Service joked it was trialling regional sirens. People were waking up to pranks all morning yesterday as April Fools swung into action, providing some much needed belly laughs. It's the only day in the calendar where the truth is hard to come by. Across the web, fake announcements and features were published on social media. April 1st may feel like any other spring day, but for those pranksters intent on causing mischief, it's their day to shine, and 2025 put on a good show with one announcement telling public transport users that they would no longer be allowed to wear shoes on the train. Number 1. The British Transport Police. The Transport Cops said it was announcing new measures which would see the mandatory removal of outdoor footwear on trains, trams and tubes. A spokesperson for the British Transport Police said that the groundbreaking step is being introduced following a recent surge in reports to our text 61016 service of people putting their feet on seats. In one particularly shocking case, a man was left with a £150 dry cleaning bill after sitting in a muddied seat. And in another, a woman was forced to look at a pair of Crocs for the duration of the London St Pancras to Sheffield service. The measures come into force on May the 1st, and officers will have the power to seize and destroy any outdoor footwear worn on the carriages and or direct offenders to leave the service at the next station. Number 2. Cadbury's Liquid Form Cream Eggs. Cadbury dazzled its followers with a squeezy cream egg sachet and a video of the new treat being thrown over a load of chips. A spokesperson for Cadbury said, "Move over boring condiments, cream egg on the goo is here." Number 3. Owestry Fire Station. Breaking the hearts of its loyal followers following Owestry's fire station, Shropshire claimed it would be closing its social media account unless people realised what day it was. A spokesperson for the Owestry Fire Station said, "After careful review, we regret to inform our followers that the Owestry Fire Station Facebook page will be closing down permanently at the end of this week. We'd like to thank every single one of you for your support over the years. Our final post will be this Friday, unless of course someone starts a petition or realises what day it is." Number 4. The West Midlands Ambulance trialling new siren. The region's ambulance service claimed it would be trialling a new siren service with some pretty choice options. A spokesman for the West Midlands Ambulance Service said, "We're trialling a brand new siren sound for each region. Will you choose 'Excuse us, Bab,' or maybe 'Come me through, Duck?" Number 5. The soon-to-be Universal Resort, Telford. Posted by prankster Kieran on social media, he claimed that Universal Studios would be bringing a brand new Universal Resort to Telford.
Hi, this is Debbie with some articles from The Express and Star from the 3rd of April. Empty Care Home to be Flattened for New Homes by Christian Barnett. This article is accompanied by a colour photograph of two-storey flat-roofed buildings with trees in the foreground. The caption reads, "The former Grafton Lodge care home will be knocked down." An empty care home in Oldbury will be demolished to make way for new housing. The former Grafton Lodge care home in Oldbury will be knocked down and replaced with 18 new affordable homes according to a planning application backed by Sandwell Council. The care home was deemed not fit for purpose and surplus to requirements by the Black Country Local Authority, which agreed to put the building on the market. The site was valued between £600,000 and £630,000, with the former the estimate price if the land was used for new homes. The local authority said it was open to offers under the market value if it meant more affordable housing was built. A mix of affordable 2- and 3-bed homes would be built after the former care home was demolished, according to the application by developer Keon Homes and Citizen Housing. The council's planners said the homes were a satisfactory standard to be approved and they would have a limited impact on the amenity of the surrounding area. The report said there are no adverse impacts which would significantly and demonstrably outweigh the benefits of approving the application, having particular regard to key policies for directing development to sustainable locations, making effective use of land, securing well-designed places and providing affordable homes individually or in combination. Grafton Lodge Care Home was threatened with closure in 2010, with the facilities deemed outdated before eventually being deemed surplus to requirements more than a decade later. Famous toy and bike shop to close up after 160 years by Mark Andrews. This article is accompanied by a colour photograph showing an elderly couple standing in front of plate glass windows of a shop entitled BD Price Superstore. The caption reads, "BD Price is closing after 160 years with the retirement of owners Dan Price and Pat Smith." A toy and cycle shop, beloved by generations of children, is to close after 160 years in a Black Country village. BD Price in Sedgley near Dudley is to close after present owner Dan Price decided to retire after 60 years supplying toys and cycles to youngsters from around the area. The business dates back to 1865 when Dan's great-grandfather, DJ Price, and his wife opened a cycle shop from the front of their terraced house in High Holborn, Sedgley. Today the shop, which is located more or less on the site where it started, seems like a relic from a bygone era, even if the premises themselves are actually quite modern. Shelves and shelves of Airfix kits, train sets, Corgi models and Skeletrix cars, tins of paint, brushes and polystyrene cement, an aisle of dolls and dozens of bikes next to the cash register. At its height, the business also had branches in Greatbridge, King Swinford and Wolverhampton. But Dan says a combination of a decline in traditional toys, the move towards internet shopping and tax rises in last year's budget means it's not possible to sell the business on to a new owner. "It's sad, but I'm quite relieved to finally be retiring," he says. 20 years ago, we might have been able to sell the business on, but you can see how quiet it is now. Because we own the building, we don't have to worry about rent, but if we did, we wouldn't have been able to carry on. We do online sales and that's what's kept the business going. This current government isn't helping at all. You can't increase taxes by the amount they have. The young lads don't buy Airfix kits. It's all click, click, click on their electronic devices. I recently saw a man who said, "I used to make toy prams for you, but how many girls do you see pushing toy prams today?" We don't sell board games anymore either. People don't play them. It's all click, click on the computer games. The majority of our customers today are older people who collect the toys and models that they had as kids for nostalgic purposes. Also calling it a day will be Dan's sister, Pat Smith, although she has largely taken a back seat from the business in recent years. Dan says the business expanded in 1885 when it acquired a former nail factory in neighbouring Tipton Street and began making bikes, which were sold under the Sedgley Beacon name. "They were available in any colour you like, as so long as it was black with gold and red lines to set them off," he says. In the 1930s, Dan's father, Bernard, took over the shop, which was renamed BD Price. "An extension was built that virtually doubled the size of the production facility," says Dan, "but when the war came along, the factory was taken over for special war production, making beds for troop ships and hospitals, and the bike production was wound down after that." Dan was born in the cellar of the shop in High Holborn, in 1940 and found himself helping out at an early age. But after leaving school, he instead decided to train as an accountant, returning in the mid-1960s following the death of his father. When my father died in the early 60s, my mother decided to continue running the shop, he says. The reconstruction of a new shopping arcade in Sedgley High Street in the 1960s allowed the business to move to a more spacious shop and business boomed. We were one of the first stockists of Playmobil, Dan recalls. In the late 1980s, as the leases on the shop came to an end, the opportunity arose for him to return to High Holborn when the original premises and a neighbouring butcher's shop came onto the market. That enabled us to demolish the two terrace properties and build the current store with an office above. The closing down sale has begun, although Dan and Pat do not yet have a closing date. The way things are going, it will take us 4 or 5 years to sell the stock, he says with a wry smile. Then we will put the premises on the market. Dan says he plans to use his well-earned retirement to spend more time with his grandchildren. What will he miss most when he retires? Probably looking at the way things are going at the moment, a lot of boredom, he says again with a waspish glint in his eye, before adding, I have met a lot of very nice people over the years. Embedded in the text of the article is a circular photograph of Dan being framed by a large hoop. 5 more people jailed for part in £4 million drug operation. Investigation started by a pharmaceutical giant uncovered the illegal network by Paul Jenkins. 5 more people have been jailed for their part in a multi-million pound drug manufacturing network, which involved members of a gang from across the Black Country. Lee Lloyd, Kyle Smith, Mark Bailey and linchpins Brian Pitts and Katie Harlow had already been sentenced at Wolverhampton Crown Court for their part in the operation, after an investigation started by a pharmaceutical company uncovered the network, which peddled £4 million worth of drugs. Scott Tonkinson, Anthony Pitts, Jordan Pitts, Deborah Bellingham and Bladen Roper have now also been given substantial jail sentences of over 21 years collectively. In January 2018, pharmaceutical company Pfizer Limited initiated an investigation into darknet market sellers operating as milkmen 11U and UKBK, who were selling bulk quantities of tablets advertised as Xanax, a medicine previously manufactured by Pfizer. Pfizer identified individuals responsible for shipping the fake tablets and began to pass information to West Midlands Police in 2018, whilst continuing to investigate the group. At the beginning of 2019, dark web investigation units were set up in regional organised crime units across the UK, and West Midlands Police took on the investigation to trace others involved in the manufacture and sale of counterfeit Xanax, the active ingredient of which is alprazolam. Officers executed a warrant at an address in Wednesbury in August 2019, where thousands of counterfeit tablets were in the process of being heat-sealed in foil bags. In Tipton, another warrant was executed where, in a garden shed, officers found an industrial powder mixer, an industrial-style drying unit, and all surfaces were covered with a pink and white powder, the signs of production of Red Street variant counterfeit Xanax-style pills. The following month, a warrant in Wolverhampton revealed a tablet press machine, metal pill cast and stamped along with powder and a handwritten recipe list. Anthony Pitts, aged 41 of Belmont Close, Tipton, was sentenced to 5 years and 5 months after pleading guilty to conspiracy to supply Class C drugs, conspiracy to commit a trademark offence and conspiracy to avoid a prohibition on exporting Class C drugs. Jordan Pitts, aged 26 of Hickman Road, Tipton, was jailed for 3 years after being found guilty of assisting in the commission of an offence. Tonkinson, aged 36 of Arundel Road, Willenhall, was jailed for 4 years and 6 months after admitting conspiracy to commit a trademark offence, conspiracy to supply Class C drugs and evading prohibition restriction on exporting Class C drugs. Bellingham, aged 58 of Windsor Road, Tipton, was jailed for 4 years and 11 months after admitting to conspiracy to supply Class C drugs and conspiracy to commit a trademark offence. Roper, aged 25 of Starbridge Road, Brierley Hill, was jailed for 3 years and 3 months. He has also been given a driving ban for 21 years and 6 months after being found guilty of assisting in the commission of an offence. Man on murder charge after loved woman found dead by Lisa O'Brien. This article is accompanied by woman with dark hair up in a bun wearing large gold earrings and a matching head decoration and a peach-coloured top. A man has appeared in court charged with murder after a woman was found dead at an address in Albury. Harminder Matu, age 50, is charged with the murder of Paramjit Kaur. The 46-year-old woman was found with serious injuries at an address in Swan Crescent at around 8:20 a.m. on Monday and was confirmed dead at the scene. Matu of Swan Crescent, Albury, appeared before Wolverhampton magistrates yesterday. He was remanded in custody to appear at Wolverhampton Crown Court on a date to be arranged. In a statement, her family said, "On March the 31st, we were deeply saddened by the heartbreaking news of Paramjit Kaur Soni's passing. A kind, hard-working and dearly loved daughter, sister and friend, she brought warmth to everyone around her. Her loss leaves us in profound sorrow, but her memory will forever live in our hearts. Officers will be carrying out additional patrols in the area to reassure and support the local community over the coming days, and police urge anyone with concerns or information to contact them." New Machine at Work on Pothole-Ridden Roads by Daniel Walton. This article is accompanied by two colour photographs. The first shows men standing beside a machine with, and they're wearing high-vis jackets, and the caption reads, "Sandwell Council's Councillor Keith Allen with the pothole repair team." The second picture shows three men, two with shovels, shovelling in a pothole, and the other one sitting in the machine driving it, and the caption to that reads, "The multi-hog reduces what would be a two-day job into only one." There's also a cartoon of triangular traffic road sign bordered in red, and there's a cartoon car in there with one wheel falling into a pothole in the road, and the caption for that reads, "The menace of potholes." Sandwell Council has rolled out its new £150,000 pothole filling machine to help tackle problems with ruts on the borough's roads. Dozens of Sandwell Council workmen, armed with shovels and brushes, were on hand to welcome the latest recruit in the fight to keep the region's carriageways in good repair. The multi-hog road planer is used to scrape the holes in preparation for the infilling material, which is then flattened by the crew, meaning the pothole disappears within seconds. During a roadwork scheme, the crews were able to quickly complete repairs in a 120-foot stretch of pothole-riddled Devil Road in Wednesbury at the junction with Manor House Road. The machine was purchased by the council in June 2024 for £150,000 as part of its efforts to fix road damage across the borough. "We watched the machine, which is equipped with a mechanical planing gear, in action as it repaired this road surface in a timescale that would previously take up to an hour by manual labour alone. The new machine forms a part of Sandwell Council's commitments to road repair and resurfacing, with the council investing £55 million into the highways in the coming financial year. The council highway site supervisor Lee Priest from Albury said that the machine turns what would be a two-day job into only one. "It's a really good bit of machinery. What you can see it doing now is planing off the surface of the road, which are smaller potholes in it, which will then be filled in by the team. The problem with manual digging is that our site workers can only dig for around 80 minutes before being required to have a break or switch out. This allows us to dig the road consistently without stopping, saving what is around a day of work and the workers' hands," Mr. Priest said. Councillor Keith Alcock, Sandwell Council's Cabinet Member for Environment and Highways, added that the machine has endless uses. Councillor Alcock says, "It's a bit like the Thunderbird of machines. It can have hedge cutters, scrape and brush the roads, and be used as a gritter in colder weather. It's a true multi-purpose machine. This machine will mean that disruptions to traffic will be lower, and it's better for the operators and site workers. It's genuinely a win-win machine. It's a machine that lessens the strain on workers and does the job faster, which means less disruption to residents and ultimately fewer costs. The machine will be utilised in pothole hotspots around the borough, with plans for the machine to be used for various jobs, including gritting when needed."
This is Lauren with some stories from the Express and Star from the 4th of April. Grant will create community space at new hospital. A £250,000 grant from the National Lottery Heritage Fund will go towards restoring 100-year-old stained glass windows from a former Birmingham hospital's mortuary. The windows, originally at City Hospital, will be relocated to the Winter Gardens at the Midland Metropolitan University Hospital in Smethwick. Money raised by National Lottery players will also pay for activities within the Commons, a community-designed and built living nature installation at the new hospital, which was opened by Sandwell and West Birmingham NHS Trust in October last year. And it will fund two other projects, an audio trail which will involve patients, staff and the community gathering and recording their memories around the history of City Hospital, and a TV treasure trove of memories in film format of the hospital, which will be shown in the People's Gallery at the Midland Met. Sandra Taylor, Senior Arts and Heritage Manager for Your City and Metropolitan Hospitals Charity, the Trust's charitable arm, which secured the Heritage Fund grant, said, "These projects will enable us to explore and celebrate the history of our hospital, whilst also restoring windows which are of historical significance." Pub facing review after man was knocked out. Violent incident took place outside during early hours lock-in. Written by Christian Barnett, local Democracy reporter. A pub will have its licence reviewed after a man was knocked unconscious during an early hours lock-in. The Old Crown Inn in Sandwell Road, West Bromwich, has been closed since last month following calls for an urgent review by West Midlands Police over a fight outside the venue where a man was knocked unconscious and required emergency assistance. The force said it is still investigating the offence of grievous bodily harm, GBH, over the fight. A report, which will be discussed by Sandor Council's Licensing Committee, said the fight broke out at around 2:55 a.m. on March 1st, nearly 90 minutes after the pub should have closed. The pub's licence means it can sell alcohol until 1 a.m. on Friday nights and must close by 1:30 a.m. Police said CCTV footage from 15 minutes earlier showed the pub fully illuminated and people standing outside, with a small number of people leaving. The footage then captured the fight at around 2:55 a.m, where crowds of people are then seen leaving, according to the police's application for a review. As a result of the serious incident, the force said it had no confidence the conditions of the licence were being upheld and serious concerns about the pub remaining open. In the police review application, it said, "Given the seriousness of the incident and the disorder shown on the CCTV, including patrons of the venue, and the fact it occurs at a time when the premises should have ceased licensable activity and be closed to the public, West Midlands Police has no confidence that the licensing objectives are being promoted." Sandwell's public health officers agreed, saying the disorder and violence associated with the venue pose a clear risk to public safety and well-being, necessitating urgent action. The violent incident also raised significant concerns regarding the management and operation of the venue, public health added. An urgent review was held behind closed doors on March 14th, where the pub's licence was suspended until a full hearing. The pub's designated supervisor, Maurice Delroy McLeod, was also removed from the licence. The pub's licence holder is Orville Hines. Sandor Council's licensing committee meets in Albury on April 9th. Alongside this article is a small image of the pub itself. It just looks like a brick building with six large windows and a grey door. It has a slanted grey roof with two chimneys, and in front of it, a red car is parked. It's captioned, "The pub's licence is suspended." Dipton Slasher Heritage Trail set to be knockout. Written by Marley Reed Hodgkins. Preparations are in hand for the launch of a new heritage trail to commemorate the Tipton Slasher. William Perry, the Tipton Slasher, was a famous heavyweight prize fighter in the 1800s. His remains lie in St John's Churchyard in Dudley, and his statue stands in Coronation Gardens in Tipton. On April 25th, at midday, local history buffs will gather at the church in St John's Road, Cates Hill, for a special unveiling of his renovated headstone and the launch of the new trail. The project is being organised by Tipton Town Library Local History Group in partnership with the church. The Heritage Trail features locations relating to Perry, who won multiple bare-knuckle fights in his career, including the heavyweight championships of 1850 and 1853. Notable sites include his statue, sculpted by Bill Haynes, which was unveiled in 1993, the Foundation Inn, which served as his headquarters in the early parts of his career, and the Tipton Railway Station. The statue will be number one on the trail. This year marks the centenary of the church's involvement in fundraising for periodic repairs to the Slasher's headstone, which was originally installed in 1925. The last time it was repaired in the 1980s. Group Chairman Rob Hazel said the latest fundraising effort included a Tipton Slasher calendar, a GoFundMe page which has so far raised £350, and a special Slasher treasure hunt. After losing his England champion title in 1857, he became a pub landlord before dying in Bilston in 1880. Alongside this article, it is a picture of Rob Hazel in front of the statue, which marks the start of the trail. They are in a park. There are trees and grass in the background. On the left-hand side of the picture is the statue, built on top of a brick column. It is made of stone, grey. He is stood in a boxing position, one foot in front of the other, two fists up in the air, and there is a plaque written on the brick wall, but it is illegible to us. On the right hand side of the picture and closer to the camera is Rob Hazel, the group chairman of the fundraising efforts. He too is in a boxing stance, two fists in the air. He is smiling, laughing, wearing a grey jumper. He has glasses and is bald. Captioned, Rob Hazel of Tipton Library Local History Group gets set for the new trail. Post Office confirms service is closing down. Written by Lauren Hill. The Post Office, located inside Morrison's Daily in Great Barr, has issued an apology following the announcement that the store and postal service will soon be closing. Locals spoke of their dismay as the news broke last week that their handy Morrison's Daily is one of the stores that is set to close as part of the nationwide cuts. It comes as supermarket giant Morrison's announced plans to shut 52 in-store cafes, 18 market kitchens, 17 convenience stores, 13 florists, 35 meat counters, 35 fish counters and 4 pharmacies, putting more than 300 jobs at risk. Bosses claim it is costing more to run the services than they are making. The Queslet Road branch also houses a post office. There was some speculation as to whether the post office would remain, but a spokesperson has confirmed that the store will be closing next Wednesday and will not be replaced. The Morrison's Daily store will be closing on April 16th. A post office spokesperson apologised for the late announcement in a statement, which read, "We fully recognise the inconvenience this will cause. There are nearby branches at King's Standing and Queslet Road." Alongside this article is an image. In the background, there is the Morrison's Daily shop. The shop has sliding grey doors and is slightly out of focus. At the forefront of the picture is Jerry Ashford. She is a black woman with brown curly hair. She is wearing a grey hoodie and a black puffer coat. She is holding a parcel that she's just collected, presumably, and is smiling at the camera. Captioned, "Local Jerry Ashford frequently used the post office inside the Morrison's for collecting and sending parcels."
Hello, this is Sarvjit with your news from the Express and Star, dated Saturday the 5th of April. Inquest on Baggies supporter to examine response of medics. By Dave Higgins, Press Association. There is a picture of Mark Townsend, who died aged 57. The response of medics after a football fan was taken ill at a championship football match will be considered at an inquest into his death later this year, a coroner has ruled. A pre-inquest review was held on Thursday following the death of Mark Townsend, 57, a West Brom fan who died after he became unwell at Sheffield Wednesday's Hillsborough Stadium on September 28, 2024. Sheffield Senior Coroner Tanika Rawdon fixed the date of the inquest into Mr. Townsend's death for September 29, saying it could last up to 2 weeks. Deciding the scope of the inquest, Mrs. Rawdon said the hearing will consider issues including what medical equipment was available at the ground and its functionality. What were the qualifications of the medical staff available in the ground, the number of medically qualified staff in the ground, and the response to Mark being unwell. She said this would include the timing of the response, the nature of the response, and the appropriateness of the medical treatment given. The coroner said the so-called interested persons in the inquest, who have a right to ask questions at the hearing, will be Mr. Townsend's family, Sheffield Wednesday Football Club, Yorkshire Ambulance Service, Lambda Medical, the private company which provided medical cover at Hillsborough, and the Sports Ground Safety Authority. The court heard how there is a disconnect between different witness accounts in relation to the timings of the events in the stadium. But Mrs. Rawdon said she hoped this would be cleared up by a large amount of CCTV footage which is being provided to the court by Sheffield Wednesday from 3 different cameras and which will be shown at the inquest. Ian Perkins for Sheffield Wednesday said there was a medical response within at least 3, if not 4 minutes. The coroner said there will be a further pre-inquest review on August 28, but only if this is needed. Teen is guilty of Josiah's murder by Adam Smith. There is a picture of flowers and tributes which were left following Josiah Coke's death in August. A teenager has been convicted of murdering a 13-year-old boy during what he told jurors was a drug-related row. A month-long trial heard Josiah Coke died at a house in Albury on August 29 last year after suffering a 6-inch deep chest wound inflicted with severe force, which almost completely cut through one of his ribs. Jurors at Wolverhampton Crown Court deliberated for 9 hours and 31 minutes over 3 days before convicting a teenage boy who cannot be identified because of his age by a majority 10-2 verdict. The youth, sitting in the well of the court beside his mother, showed no emotion as he watched the verdict being returned by the foreman of the jury. A co-defendant aged in his 40s, who cannot be named for legal reasons, was cleared of assisting an offender by harbouring the youth before his arrest. Josiah's killer, who denied deliberately inflicting any injuries, fled over fences and then caught a bus to a friend's house to play video games in the hours after the killing, the court heard. Jurors were told the victim was found dead in the hallway of the house by paramedics responding to a 999 call made by the defendant. Forensic evidence included diluted blood found on a kitchen chair suggested an attempt had been made to clean up something or someone after the killing. Sentence in the case and a ruling on a press application to lift reporting restrictions has been adjourned until June. After the verdicts, Mrs. Justice Tipples thanked jurors for their hard work and excused the panel from future jury service for life. She told the jurors, "This has been a tragic case in which a 13-year-old child was killed." Brazen thief risks serious harm soaring EV cables by Daniel Walton. There is a picture of a man who can be seen soaring through the cables of the charging port. CCTV footage has caught the shocking moment a daring thief soared through the cables of an electric vehicle charging port before stealing the wires. The alarming CCTV footage was released as part of an appeal by electric vehicle known as EV Charging Network Group B.EV, whose machine at Gallagher Retail Park in Wednesbury was vandalised just after 8:20 p.m. on March 12. The footage shows the thief walking onto the B.EV charging bay near the Decathlon store before haphazardly soaring through the cables and then dragging them out of sight of the cameras. At one point, while vandalising the machine, the man looks up at the camera before looking around to make sure no one is watching. Since the theft took place, B.EV has placed around 50 wanted posters in the area in a bid to catch the thief. The posters show a screenshot of the man's face with the words, "Do you know this man?" It can be seen at expressandstar.com. The description on the poster also reads, "This thug's stupidity in stealing copper cables worth £15 or less means drivers can't charge their EVs and his action risks serious harm by electrocution." The group said that EV charging theft is an increasingly massive issue for the industry, costing upwards of £1 million a year. Asif Ghaffour, CEO of B.EV, said, "Whilst the cables are only worth a few pounds in scrap, they will cost thousands to replace and inconvenience families wanting to charge at the site. We have produced some wanted posters to see if we can help identify the person in the footage and have put 40 to 50 of these posters up in the surrounding area." The group added that they have been working with policing teams to tackle EV charging thefts, calling on organisations to come together to stop further crimes. Mr. Ghaffour added, "EV charging theft is a massive issue costing the industry upwards of £1 million. This is why B.EV has done this. Unfortunately, whilst the impact to drivers and us is great, this needs coordination with police, EV CPOs and scrapyards to bring this to an end." Information about the theft can be given to West Midlands Police via the live chat service on their website, or alternatively by calling their 101 number. West Midlands Police has been approached for comment. Eco alternatives for your spring cleaning routine. It's spring again, and traditionally a time to give our homes a good spruce up. Here are some natural alternatives to harmful chemical-based cleaners. They get the job done, work out cheaper, and won't hurt the environment or your health. Number 1. Vinegar. Vinegar mixed with an equal amount of water makes a powerful glass and surface cleaner. You can add the mixture to a spray bottle and use it to wipe away soap scum, mineral deposits and grease. Use distilled white vinegar and test it on an inconspicuous area before applying more liberally. Number 2. Essential oils. Adding a few drops of tea tree, lavender or eucalyptus oil to your DIY cleaners leaves a fresh, natural scent. Essential oils can help banish nasty smells from bins, fridges and laundry rooms. Number 3. Baking soda. Baking soda is an effective and natural way to scrub surfaces and deodorize. It can even unclog blocked drains. Mix it with a little water to make a paste which can eliminate grease and grime from countertops, sinks and ovens. You can also mix the paste with a little soap to remove scorch marks from pots and pans. Baking soda is a great carpet freshener too. Sprinkle it on and let it sit on the carpet for a few hours before vacuuming. Number 4. Lemon juice. Another effective natural cleaner is lemon juice. It's one of the best and cheapest dishwasher rinse and liquids available, and you'll love the smell of your dishes after every wash. Lemon juice can also be used to add sparkle to taps, pots and cutlery, and works as a great chemical-free furniture polish too. Just mix one part lemon juice with two parts olive oil and mix. It also works on hard wood floors. Finally, did you know that lemon juice can help keep insects out of your home? Just rub some on the door and window frames. Insects hate the smell, and so it keeps them away. Number 5. Natural scrubbing products. Most cleaning sponges you can buy in the supermarket are made of plastic. When they're being used, tiny pieces falling off can contribute to the microplastics in our water supply. And since they can't be recycled, they end up in landfill sites. Instead, look for scrubbers made from natural materials like walnut fibres, coconut husks, or bamboo. Avoid single-use wipes altogether. They're made from plastic and won't break down naturally, clogging up pipes and waterways or dumped in landfills. Choose reusable cloths and biodegradable alternatives instead. Also, choose refillable spray bottles over disposable ones. Exhibition by partially sighted artist left her visitors amazed. By Lauren Hill. There is a picture of Kemby Maynard, who's sharing her life in paintings at an exhibition held at Cannock Library on March 25. A spectacular exhibition by a partially sighted Cannock artist depicts her life through dating, job hunting, and public transport. Kemby Maynard shared her life in paintings at an exhibition held at Cannock Library on March 25, with each painting exploring her life experiences as a visually impaired person. Kemby was born with optic atrophy, a condition characterized by damage to the optic nerve, which ultimately leads to vision loss, and was diagnosed when she was 4 years old. The 31-year-old says, "Unlike a regular sighted person who can merely glance at something and take in information, it takes her a lot longer to observe and comprehend. Despite this, she went to Birmingham City University to study fine art. Inspired by the likes of Frida Kahlo, Kara Walker and Faith Ringgold. I have always been into art, as far as I can remember," said Kemby. "I love to draw, paint and write poetry, and I wanted to continue my love for it. Those artists, as well as the people around me, inspired me to do what I love." One of her pieces, called Blind Kiss, is about her first experience of dating as a visually impaired person. "I love that piece. It has some sentimental value to me," she said. "It reminds me of a time when I was getting used to dating, feeling the first kiss as a blind individual. It was quite strange to me. Any first kiss is awkward and strange, but to me it was more so." She says she often struggles with reading public transport signs, such as bus services, and often has to ask the driver which service they are operating. However, she loves where she lives in Norton Keynes and the community around her. "It has been a great experience living here in Cannock," said Kemby. "I love the friendly people. You don't feel like they are taking advantage of you, and you feel a close connection to the community. It is beautiful in the spring and summer. It is just a wonderful place to live." She added that the exhibition was a success and enjoyed by many. "It went really well. I had mostly friends and family on the launch night, and people started coming in during the month. They have been amazed about my art and how I came to do it." More of Kemby's artwork can be seen on her Instagram page at Kemby Maynard.
Hello, this is Jenny. The following articles are from the Express and Star newspaper, Monday the 7th of April. Lego Paradise raises funds. An article by Isabel Parkin. Lego creations inspired by Star Wars and Ghostbusters were just some of those on display at the Black Country Brick Show, as the popular event returned for its fifth year. Phoenix Collegiate School in West Bromwich was transformed into a Lego fan's paradise this weekend for the return of the two-day event. Attendees of all age were invited through the doors, some greeted by Star Wars characters such as Chewbacca and a stormtrooper on their way in. Around 90 exhibitors from around the world were expected to attend the event across the weekend, displaying their impressive Lego creations. The event raises funds for Birmingham Children's Hospital and the Lego charity Fairy Bricks. Event promotes economic growth through healthcare. MPs and innovators gather to help address NHS waiting lists and inequalities. An article by Karen Stevenson, your World Contributor. An event in Parliament brought together MPs and innovators to hear how more than 100,000 hours of NHS staff time is saved each year. West Bromwich MP Sarah Coombs sponsored the event involving Health Innovation West Midlands and the National Health Innovation Network event. It was aimed at building support for innovations, helping to address urgent NHS priorities, such as reducing waiting lists, tackling health inequalities, and improving the updates of medicines. It was attended by 10 MPs and members of the House of Lords, leaders from the Health Innovation Network, and 6 innovators from across the country. The businesses showcased the results of their collaborations with the Health Innovation Network and its 15 regional networks. They included QB Tech, part of the national programme called Focus ADHD. QB Tech's innovative ADHD assessment has helped tackle NHS waiting list challenges and supported over 70,000 young people during the pilot. The MP said, "Meeting with and hearing from innovators from across the country has been so inspiring. These programmes are delivering real results for patients across the country, and I know that my constituents in West Bromwich will feel the benefit of improved healthcare. The Health Innovation Network are positively impacting health outcomes and also driving regional and national growth. They are truly the engine of both health and growth in the UK." Tim Jones, Chief Officer, Health Innovation West Midlands, said, "We were delighted to meet with Sarah Coombs to discuss innovations in West Bromwich. Working closely with MPs and policymakers enables us to deliver local change faster and more widespread, ensuring all patients benefit from innovation." Music and colour at school's first ever celebration of culture. A Black Country school was alive with colour, music and celebration recently as the school community came together for its first ever Culture Day. Culture Day was a joyful event at Gospel Oak School in Tipton, part of the Central Region Schools Trust, designed to celebrate the rich diversity within the school and promote a culture of respect, understanding and unity. Students from all year groups and staff members took part in a variety of exciting activities throughout the day, from wearing traditional cultural clothing to exploring the meaning of culture in specially designed tutor sessions. The day gave students the opportunity to reflect on their own backgrounds and learn more about their peers' heritages. As part of the celebrations, students created unique bunting to represent their cultural identity or influences, which together formed a vibrant visual display. Students also took part in a live artwork session led by local artist Andy's Doodles, who captured what culture looks like at Gospel Oak through collaborative drawing. The day culminated in a high-energy assembly, featuring a fashion show of traditional and cultural wear from around the world. The assembly also featured a specially commissioned poem performed by poet Matt Windle. Windle, who goes by the name Poet with a Punch, is both a professional boxer and 3 times Birmingham Poet Laureate. At lunchtime, students were treated to global flavours, sampling foods such as Jamaican plantain crisps, Polish biscuits, samosas and Victoria sponge cake. Henna painting stations and music added to the festive atmosphere. The day left a strong impression on students, with Treasure, a Year 10 student, commenting, "I love seeing everyone's traditional clothes and learning about my friends' and classmates' traditions. I didn't realise how many different cultures are represented in our school." Stephen Brownlow, principal of Gospel Oak School, praised the event as an important moment for the school community. "Celebrating heritage and creating artwork forms part of the Central Region Schools Trust Enrichment Offer, ensuring all students can access a rounded education beyond the classroom. Gospel Oak School is committed to delivering an educational experience. Polish bakery tantalises the taste buds of new clientele. An article by Mike Sheridan. An expanding Midlands bakery chain aiming to bring a taste of Eastern Europe to the high streets of England is set to open its 10th store this year. Masovia, a small chain of Polish bakeries with 7 outlets including Telford, Walsall, Kidderminster and West Bromwich, reckon English customers have taken them to their hearts. And they say their success is down to the UK high street discovering a love for the flavours of Eastern Europe. The firm began as a bakery operation to supply bread to Polish shops in the Midlands. And although the company still bakes thousands of loaves a day at its Walsall unit, it's now enjoying rapid success with its own brand bakeries. The company is run by co-owners Greg Zajczowski, Paweł Podolol and Christoph Podlak, who all originally hail from Poland, with the name Masovia coming from the English translation of Mazowsze, a region in the Polish Midlands. They say they started the business to help bring a taste of home to Polish people living in the UK. But now they put its success down to the impact of English customers buying into the adventure of Eastern European food and culture. The first shop was Walsall, based around many Polish shops there. The next in West Bromwich. We thought we were opening businesses for Polish customers, but our dream was always to bring in English customers. Now it's the total opposite. In some of our bakeries, 80% of the customers are English people, said Director Greg. The firm celebrated its most recent opening in Shrewsbury in December last year, adding to existing cafes in Telford, Walsall, Kidderminster, Redditch, Erdington and West Bromwich. Now, Greg says the warm welcome the business received from the happy customers in Shropshire has given them a platform for further success, 3 years after opening the company's first shop in Walsall. It's going much better than we expected. We're surprised by how warm the welcome was in Shrewsbury, he added. Our Shrewsbury customers are so happy. They're fantastic people, but each place is so different. The company plans to open a further 3 shops before the end of the year, but says growing organically remains the priority, with no particular target in mind. Instead, the firm intends to continue focusing on what it says are its key differences as it continues to expand. The group is set to launch a range of healthy breakfasts this month, in search of what Greg describes as a more upmarket offering. But he added that staying affordable was set to remain an important part of what they do. There was one review on Facebook from a customer which said, "We were cheaper than Greg's," he said. School with unique links to CBSO is an exciting place to be. Shireland CBSO Academy in West Bromwich was founded in 2023 and gives its children a unique focus on music. It is a non-selective secondary academy serving Sandwell and the West Midlands, developed in partnership with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, CBSO. The academy is the first state school in the country to form a partnership with a professional orchestra. Students attending the academy receive a broad education covering the full national curriculum with an expectation that they will strive for academic and musical excellence. Shireland CBSO Academy is supported by Shireland Collegiate Academy Trust, a well-established multi-academy trust that currently operates 5 primaries and 5 secondary academies and 2 nurseries. Founded by 3 times Ofsted Outstanding Shireland Collegiate Academy, the Trust has a national reputation for innovation, collaboration and inspiring individuals to reach their full potential. Speaking on the Academy, its principal David Green said, This is a really exciting school to be a part of because we're the first school in the country to be established in partnership with a professional orchestra, the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. In terms of our aims for the first year and beyond, it's really to ensure that while our students get a fantastic, really broad curriculum, we follow the full national curriculum. We are providing a level opportunity around music that just wouldn't exist otherwise for our students. Our children have had world-famous musicians in front of them. They have had the orchestra supporting them on a regular basis. They all get an instrumental vocal lesson each week, and it's a really special place, both for their wider education, but also specifically around music. One of the key things David has seen since the doors opened 2 years ago is its focus on pastoral support, making sure the children build key skills in things like resilience, teamwork, empathy, and self-discipline. He added, "I think this is a really special place, and it's helping us to ensure that students are able to do really well. We really strive for academic and musical excellence, but that's really underpinned by strong pastoral support. And I think our pastoral structures are strong, and students understand our ethos and our key values, which mirror those of our trust, Shiloh Collegiate Academy. I think putting those things together mean that students have a great opportunity here to do well. There have been several events that have taken place over the last 2 years, including an official opening with the Duke of Edinburgh."
Welcome back to the Express and Star Pub Quiz, and this week's round, it's music. Question 1. Which same title, different song, has been a hit for Elvis Presley and Bobby Brown? Question 2. What first name links the lead singers of Rolls Royce and No Doubt? Question 3. Who, at the age of 7, appeared in the video for Bob Marley's Is This Love and went on to become a supermodel? Question 4. Who scored a number one with their debut hit in 1972 and followed it up with their only other chart entry called Desperate Dan? Question 5. What follows Edwin and Atlantic to give the names of two chart acts? Question 6. Which chart act was made up of siblings Jim, John, Frank, Kathy, Anne and Helen? Question 7. Crazy in Love, Are You Ready for Love and Where Is the Love were all UK number one hits in which year? Question 8. Which music group was established by conductors Sir Thomas Beecham and Malcolm Sargent in 1932? Question 9. Tonight I'm Yours, Time and The Tears of Hercules are all albums by which veteran artist? And question 10. Which classical composer's Symphony No. 2 is also known as the Resurrection? How's your music knowledge? Click to the answers to find out. Here are the answers for the music round. Question 1. Which same title, different song, has been a hit for Elvis Presley and Bobby Brown? Don't Be Cruel. Question 2. What first name links the lead singers of Rose Royce and No Doubt? Gwen. Question 3. Who, at the age of 7, appeared in the video for Bob Marley's Is This Love and went on to become a supermodel? Naomi Campbell. Question 4. Who scored a number one with their debut hit in 1972 and followed it up with their only other chart entry called Desperate Dan? Lieutenant Pigeon. Question 5. What follows Edwin and Atlantic to give the names of two chart acts? Star. Question 6. Which chart act was made up of siblings Jim, John, Frank, Kathy, Anne and Helen? The Dooleys. Question 7. Crazy in Love, Are You Ready for Love, and Where is the Love were all UK number one hits in which year? It was the same year as Finding Nemo and Cristiano Ronaldo's Premier League debut, 2003. Question 8. Which music group was established by conductors Sir Thomas Beecham and Malcolm Sargent in 1932? London Philharmonic Orchestra. Question 9. Tonight I'm Yours, Time and The Tears of Hercules are all albums by which veteran artist? Rod Stewart. And question 10. Which classical composer's Symphony No. 2 is also known as The Resurrection? Gustav Mahler. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back after Easter. Bye!
When you asked to receive recordings produced by the Sandwell Talking News, you gave your name and address so that we could send you our memory sticks or CDs. This information is stored in a secure database, and address labels are also stored in a secure location. Having left our premises, the address labels and postal wallets are then under the protection and care of Royal Mail. Your contact details are only used for sending you our memory sticks or CDs and will never be forwarded to a third party. If you ask us to stop sending the Sandwell Talking News to you, your contact details will be deleted from our database and your address labels will be permanently destroyed. We promise and assure you that we take data protection seriously and make every effort to meet the requirements of the Data Protection Act. If your circumstances do change, you move home, change your phone number, or wish to unsubscribe to the Sandwell Talking News, please call the office on 0121 525 4810 or email sandwelltn@gmail.com so that we can make the necessary changes.
Time now for a listing of programmes coming up on TV, which are audio described, and radio listings for the week ahead by Talking News Federation.
Now for the audio described television programmes for Saturday 12th of April to Friday 18th of April, compiled by Lisa and read by Rebecca. On Saturday the 12th, BBC One has Escape to the Country at 2:30pm with an opera singer and his husband searching for a house in Norfolk, followed by an animated film, Shrek the Third, with Mike Myers providing the voice of Shrek. It wouldn't be Saturday without a cookery show or two, and this week at 12 noon on BBC Two, Nadia Hussain rustles up a vegan cheesecake in Nadia Bakes. Or over on ITV1 at 11:45, Prue Leith cooks yakitori chicken in her Cotswold kitchen. On BBC Two at 12:30, Interior Design Masters with Alan Carr features 10 aspiring designers giving a Lake District youth hostel a makeover. Sounds fun. For rugby fans, BBC Two also have the Women's Six Nations live from 4:25pm when Ireland play England. This is not audio described, but may be of interest. Saturday evening, light entertainment starts with Gladiators, the final, on BBC One at 5:50, followed by a brand new series of Doctor Who at 6:50, which sees the Doctor battling with robots from outer space. If Wales appeals more than outer space, then Channel 4 has Our Dream Farm with Matt Baker at 6, followed by Ancient Greece by train at 7:30, in which historian Alice Roberts learns more about the preserved city of Ephesus. Your weekly dose of casualty is available at 9:10 on BBC One when Stevie's flat is raided by armed police. There are two late-night movie offerings. Gangs of New York at 10 on Channel 4 stars Daniel Day-Lewis in an Oscar-nominated crime drama set in 19th century New York. Over on BBC Two at 11:55, The Graduate is a classic comedy drama featuring Dustin Hoffman, Anne Bancroft and the music of Simon and Garfunkel. Now for Sunday's options. There's a sporting theme to the daytime schedule with live coverage of the boat races on BBC One from 12:20, whilst BBC Two have live coverage of the Women's FA Cup semi-final between Manchester City and Manchester United from 2:35. Neither is audio described but has full commentary. Non-sports fans can still escape to the country at 4:10 on BBC One when two sisters search for a home in Somerset. BBC One offers more variety in the evening with the America's Wildlife documentary at 6:15, narrated by Tom Hanks, followed by the final episode in the current series of 10 Pound Poms at 8 p.m. and episode 4 of Liverpool-based crime drama This City Is Ours at 9 p.m. ITV One also have a crime drama, Grace, at 8 p.m, or you might prefer to join Monica Galletti and Rob Rinder on BBC Two at 8 p.m. as they visit the Knutsford Arctic Resort in Amazing Hotels Life Beyond the Lobby. A new series of The Piano is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. with a new judge joining Claudia Winkleman and Mika as they search for the UK's best amateur pianists. During the week, the regular soap operas are on at the following times. Monday, it's EastEnders at 7:30 on BBC One. Emmerdale at 7:30 on ITV One and Corrie at 8 on ITV One. Tuesday has EastEnders at 7:30 and Emmerdale at 7:30. Wednesday, it's EastEnders at 7:30 and Emmerdale at 7:30 with Corrie at 8. Thursday is EastEnders at 7:30 and Emmerdale at 7:30. No soaps on a Friday. Homes Under the Hammer fans can get their daily fix Monday to Thursday at 11:15 on BBC One and at 11:45 on Friday, which is, of course, Good Friday, of which more later on. Moving on to Monday the 14th. Daytime highlights include Bargain Hunt from Exeter at 12:15 on BBC One and Escape to the Country features the Lake District at 3. On BBC Two, visit Venice at 2:45 in Italy's Invisible Cities. Then at 4:15, Nature's Epic Journeys follows a herd of migrating caribou through Canada and Alaska. The Golden Toilet Heist sounds intriguing on BBC One at 8 p.m. The audacious theft of an 18-carat gold toilet from Blenheim Palace in 2019 became one of the country's most high-profile art thefts. Clodagh Stenson investigates. Then there's drama at 9 p.m. with episode 3 of Reunion. On BBC Two at 6:30, Michael Portillo tours the Scottish borders in Great British Railway Journeys. And at 9 p.m, Lucy Worsley is in Paris for Rebuilding Notre Dame, the last chapter. Over on Channel 4, there's a new series at 8 p.m, Secrets of Supermarket Buyers. Denise Van Outen discovers savvy shopping secrets behind the scenes at Waitrose. Later at 10 p.m, the ever-popular Gogglebox has the armchair critics sharing their options on what they've been watching. And now it's Tuesday. On BBC Two at 2:45, Jill Halfpenny's Easter Journeys has Jill investigating Easter traditions in North East England and the Scottish Borders. And later at 6:30, Michael Portillo continues his travels in Great British Railway Journeys. You might want to catch the last episode of Reunion on BBC One at 9 p.m. BBC Two's evening offerings include The Hairy Bikers Go North at 7 p.m, followed by Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing at 8 p.m. This week, Bob and Paul are endeavouring to catch pike. We stay in the water at 8:30 with Jules and Greg's Wild Swim. ITV1 has For the Love of Dogs at 8:30pm, presented by Alison Hammond. Channel 4 is slightly more serious this evening with George Clark's Amazing Spaces at 9pm, followed by a brand new series at 10, Barristers Fighting for Justice, which features some of the UK's leading defence barristers as they fight for clients accused of serious crimes. It's Wednesday and light-hearted lunchtime entertainment is available in the form of Bargain Hunt at BBC One at 12:15 when Danny Sebastian explores the Museum of Leathercraft in Northampton. Jill Halfpenny continues her Easter journey at 2:45 on BBC Two, returning to her hometown of Gateshead. BBC One has the ever-popular The Repair Shop at 8, when Ina, an instructor at a riding school for disabled people, and her star pupil Ellen are hoping that Hector, the life-sized model horse, can be repaired. Then at 9pm, Paddy McGuinness and Chris Harris visit the Greek island of Ikaria in Paddy and Chris Road Trip in Greece. Something different on BBC Two at 8pm. Rollercoaster, The Secret Genius of Modern Life with Professor Hannah Fry. Then some lovely gentle comedy at 10 with Detectorists. Channel 4 have gone with a strong building property theme this evening. We have Worst House on the Street at 8pm, followed by Grand Designs at 9pm, in which Kevin MacLeod visits an ambitious new home in Hackney. And finally, Building Britain's Superhomes is on at 10pm. Now for Thursday. A big night for fans of The Apprentice as BBC One has the final at 9pm. Who will convince Lord Sugar to make them his business partner and take the £250,000 investment? If you like this, then you won't want to miss the follow-on show, The Apprentice, You're Hired, at 10pm, where Tom Allen will interview the winner. Something completely different on BBC Two at 8pm with Digging for Britain. Volunteers in North Yorkshire digging beneath Richmond Castle trace its history. Then at 9pm, Fake or Fortune has Fiona Bruce trying to ascertain if a painting is genuine. It's Chateau DIY at 5pm on Channel 4, where the owners of Chateau Marouille are frantically preparing for their first wedding of the year. Then at 8pm in Bad Dog Academy, trainers Sean and Kamal take on two destructive St Bernards. Rather them than me. There's Real Life Hospital Drama at 9pm with 24 hours in A&E. Friday, 18th of April, is also Good Friday, so let's see what the bank holiday TV highlights are as we head into the Easter weekend. At 10:45am on BBC One, in Gareth Malone's Messiah, the likeable choirmaster coaches eight amateurs to sing Handel's Messiah. Meanwhile, BBC Two are showing classic religious epic The Robe at 10:50, starring Richard Burton. David Attenborough's many fans are in for an Easter treat at 7pm on BBC One with Attenborough and the Giant Sea Monster. Sir David joins two of the UK's most intrepid fossil hunters on the coast of Dorset. Then at 8pm in Beyond Paradise, an old sailing rivalry resurfaces at a local regatta when a sailor collapses mid-race. There's more drama on BBC Two at 9pm in Black Snow, whilst Channel 4 have What's the Big Deal? Britain's Best Buys at 8pm with Natalie Cassidy. Film fans have a treat at 10pm when BBC Two show The King's Speech, an Oscar-winning historical drama. And that concludes this week's ADTV listings. Hopefully there's something here for everyone. Happy Easter!
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, April 12th. In the afternoon drama, the film is set in 1945 and tells the story of how the head of Ministry of Information New Film Unit was faced with the challenge of how to share the truth of the Holocaust when confronted with the footage recorded during the liberation of Bergen-Belsen, and enlisted the help of his friend Alfred Hitchcock to create an irrefutable cinematic testimony. Starring Henry Goodman, drama, the film, 3 o'clock, Radio 4. Opera on 3 presents Mozart's The Magic Flute. Simon McBurney's exuberant production was first seen at the New York Metropolitan Opera in 2023. The Mozart's Magic Flute, 6 o'clock, Radio 3, Saturday evening. And Kenneth Williams, said the actor to the Bishop, is the intriguing title of Archive on 4's Easter special. The Bishop of Liverpool, James Jones, recalls how he worked with the comic Kenneth Williams on a series of recordings of Bible stories in the 70s, which have never been broadcast until now. Best known for his bawdy sense of humour and lascivious voice, the Carry On star was also, perhaps surprisingly, a man of faith, with contributions from Giles Brandeth and children's laureate Frank Cottrell Boyce. It's described as a lovely, gently instructive listen. Said the actor to the Bishop, Kenneth Williams, 8 p.m, Saturday, Radio 4. Sunday, April 13th, and fans of Take It From Here can enjoy a 1954 episode of the 1948-60 comedy by Frank Muir and Dennis Norden. 10:30 in the morning on Radio 4 Extra, or 3:30 or 9:30 in the afternoon and evening. In Private Passions, Michael Barclay welcomes writer, director, animator and comedian Terry Gilliam. Born in the US but first known for his work with the Monty Python team, he was responsible for the animated opening sequence. Now 84, he discusses his life, career and music by Berlioz, Delius and Richard Strauss. 12 noon, Radio 3 on Sunday. And how high is the sky? Why is milk white? In The Big Ask, journalist Ian Wiley considers how many questions are asked in a day and how many have meaningful answers that unlock bigger stories and deeper conversations. With contributions from people who make it their business to ask questions, from barristers, detectives to philosophers and priests. 7:15, Sunday night, Radio 4. On to programmes then that are broadcast at the same time every day of the week, Monday to Friday. So same time, same radio station each day. In Bilanguage City by Roz Perlin, the linguist meets speakers of little-known languages across New York. The first episode features a nurse from Highland, Nepal, one of only 700 people in the world who speak Sikh, and now more than 100 of them have moved to a single building in Brooklyn. 11:45, Radio 4, all week, Monday to Friday. Loneliness has been declared by the World Health Organization to be a pressing global health threat. In Beyond Lonely, Cambridge professor and sociologist Jason Arday contemplates loneliness from his own experience and that of others. He was diagnosed with autism as a child, didn't speak till he was 11, and didn't write until he was 18. 1:45, all week, same time, Radio 4. Composer of the Week focuses on Mozart's last years. Donald MacLeod follows the highs, lows and exquisite music of Mozart's last 5 years, with his Requiem featured across the week. 4 p.m, all week, Monday to Friday, Radio 3. The subject of the essay is The Sounds of Wild Poland, in which Polish nature recordist Izabela Duszyk, who was born without sight, captures the sounds of her native land, starting with the dawn in the marshes and primeval forest ending it. 9:45 p.m, Radio 3. And Book of Bedtime is One Comeback, a haunting gothic thriller in 10 parts by Rose McDonough. Emily's school friend Nicky died 20 years ago, so how can he be in a crowd watching Edinburgh's New Year fireworks? 10:45 p.m, Radio 4, Monday to Friday this week. Back to the other highlights individually for the rest of the week, starting with Monday, April 14th. Classical Live features the weekly lunchtime recital broadcast live from Wigmore Hall in London, with Petrarch Trelawney introducing new generation artists, the Chaos Quartet, in works by Schubert, Ligeti and Britten. 1 o'clock, Radio 3, Monday, April 14th. Benny Hill is the controversial subject of this week's Great Lives. Playwright Jonathan Maitland believes he deserves reassessment as a TV pioneer, but comedian and writer Helen Ledra takes a rather different view. Presented by Matthew Paris, Benny Hill, Great Lives, 3 o'clock, Radio 4 on Monday. And a new series of The Unbelievable Truth begins with David Mitchell hosting the show, in which panellists Marcus Brigstock, Holly Walsh, Lou Sanders and Tony Hawks tell lies to smuggle the truth past their opponents. The Unbelievable Truth, Radio 4, 6:30, Monday. Tuesday, April 15th, and the drama is An Inspector Calls on Moscow. It's 80 years since the first performance in 1945 of J.B. Priestley's classic play, which took place not in the West End, but in Moscow. It was said there was no London theatres available, but Mark Burgess's drama tells another story of how Churchill blocked the play's progress because the playwright was too left-leaning for the PM. It stars Rory Kinnear as J.B. Priestley, and Inspector Calls on Moscow, 2:15, Tuesday afternoon, Radio 4. Radio 3 in concert was recorded in February at the Royal Festival Hall in London. Edward Gardner conducts the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in the world premiere of British composer David Soar's Sphinx, together with Britten's Violin Concerto and Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. 7:30 p.m, Radio 3. The Witch Farm is an eight-part drama documentary about a family making a fresh start at a farmhouse in the Brecon Mountains. It stars Joseph Fiennes and Alexander Roach. 11 p.m, Radio 4, on Tuesday night. And don't forget, a bit earlier, In Touch, News for the Blind and Partially Sighted, 8:40 as always, every Tuesday on Radio 4. Wednesday, April 16th, Dr. Sian Williams went from being a high-profile news presenter to psychological therapist for the NHS. In her 7-part series Life Changing, a gentle, empathetic approach encourages guests to tell their own stories on life-changing moments without glossing over the more difficult areas. Today, she hears from a man who was blinded by an acquaintance at a teenage party. 9 a.m. for Life Changing on Radio 4. Radio 3 in Concert comes live from the Barbican in London with the BBC Symphony Orchestra playing Mahler's 4th Symphony, Dorothy Howe's symphonic poem Lamia, and Kurt Weill's 1927 cantata De Nu Offis with soprano Anu Comsi. 7:30, Wednesday night, Radio 3. And a special edition of The Moral Maze was recorded at the Nuffield Trust Summit, which took place last month in Windsor, bringing together a diverse range of NHS social care and policy leaders, disruptors and innovators, to discuss how health and care systems should respond to current and future challenges. Michael Burke, with his panelling guests, discussed the ethical purpose of the NHS. In The Moral Maze, 8 o'clock, Radio 4, on Wednesday. Thursday, April 17th, and the 6-dot code created by Louis Braille 200 years ago continues to transform the lives of blind people. In the documentary Braille and Me, presenter Emma Tracy, who uses a Braille typewriter in her work and reads stories in Braille to her children, hears from others users of the dotted language that is read with two index fingers, including an Ethiopian lawyer and a disability activist. 9:30 in the morning, BBC World Service for the documentary Braille and Me. Also on Thursday afternoon, drama about a dog, a black comedy in which Danny's wayward cousin Lee hits a pheasant with his van, setting off a chain of unfortunate events that includes a crate of deadly home brew, an assault on a police officer, and worst of all, a small dog. 2:15 on Thursday afternoon, Radio 4. And Radio 3 in Concert features a performance from last week at the Llandaff Cathedral in Cardiff. From the BBC National Chorus and the Orchestra of Wales in Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, which the composer saw as his finest achievement. 7:30 p.m. Radio 3, Thursday night. And lastly, Friday, April 18th, Good Friday. In the series of Anti-Social, Adam Fleming returns to investigate more topical issues being fiercely debated across social media, blogs, talk shows and phone-ins. With the help of guests, he offers an alternative to behaviour around so much contemporary conflict. Understanding, facts and respect. It's just after midday on Friday on Radio 4. The choice to follow a religious faith or not is individual, of course. There's not a single person whose life will not be untouched by grief. In Easter Reflections, the Reverend Kate Botley reflects upon sorrow, loss and the death of a loved one, while offering some hope from stories shared by guests and musical tracks. 7 p.m. Radio 2 on Good Friday. And the Royal Albert Hall of Fame, to mark 25 years since the first Classic FM live at the Royal Albert Hall, organist and conductor Anna Lapwood celebrates its musical history in a 3-part series, starting with the early years. Queen Victoria laid the first stone in 1867. With music from Elgar from the first ever concert, plus a look at the origins of traditions such as the annual performances of Handel's Messiah. The Royal Albert Hall of Fame, 9 p.m. Classic FM on Friday. That's it. Thank you to Leslie for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening. And also may I wish you a happy Easter.
TNS Soundings.
It's Robert here. I'm reading articles from the Express and Star dated 8th of April. Anyone for a paddle? New courts open as sports craze takes off. Article by Paul Jenkins. It's a fast-growing sport which counts David Beckham and Serena Williams amongst its fans, and now it has arrived in Samwell. 3 new paddle courts were opened at Tipton Sports Academy on Saturday, with over 150 people attending the ceremony, including leader of Samwell Council, Kerry Carmichael, and the mayor, Councillor Saida Khatun, MBE. Invented in Mexico in the 1960s, paddle is a cross between tennis and squash but played on smaller courts enclosed with glass walls, played in doubles. It uses the tennis scoring system with an underarm serve. The new courts mark a £155,000 investment by Samwell Leisure Trust, SLT, which manages 8 centres for the council, and it will see the public get chance to participate in what is said to be the fastest growing participation sport globally. Councillor Cutton cut the official opening ribbon and hit the first ball on the new courts and said, "I am always extremely proud of what we achieve and deliver in Samwell, and this is no exception as we open these wonderful new paddle courts at Tipton Sports Academy with our partners at Samwell Leisure Trust. We hope bringing one of the fastest growing sports in the world to the borough will provide yet another opportunity for our residents to get together and enjoy something new while staying fit and active." Chair of the SLT board, Penny Venables, added, "We always strive to provide high quality leisure facilities that support the health and well-being of our community. So we are thrilled to bring the highly exciting and social game of paddle to Samwell. Inclusive and accessible community facilities like this make a real difference to people's lives, and we look forward to welcoming increasing numbers of players. Bookings from the public can be made at slt/leisure.co.uk/paddle/. A picture accompanies this article captioned "Lee Marks is the tennis/paddle manager at Tipton Sports Academy," and it shows Lee, a white bald man, kneeling next to a tennis net. Death by dangerous driving trial starts years after tragedy. Article by Adam Smith. The trial of a dangerous driver accused of killing a popular Samwell carer in Tipton 4 years ago has finally begun, but without the defendant. Carlton Betts, 28, denies he was driving the stolen car which mounted the pavement and killed Darren Whitehouse on St Mark's Road, Tipton, on February 27, 2021. However, Betts did not turn up to the first day of the trial at Wolverhampton Crown Court yesterday, and his whereabouts are unknown. He previously attended to plead not guilty to death by dangerous driving. Judge Simon Ward told jurors at Wolverhampton Crown Court that Betts's absence would not stop the trial going ahead. He said, "Mr. Betts did attend the previous hearings at this court concerning this case. He was given bail. He was warned this trial would go ahead with or without him. His barrister is here to argue on his behalf, but if he does not attend, he loses the opportunity to give evidence in his defence." Betts of Union Street, Tipton, denies being behind the wheel when the tragedy occurred, and identification issues combined with missed hearings due to his ill health led to several delays in proceedings. The death of a popular carer, Darren, 43, led to a massive outpouring of grief from the local community, with floral tributes remaining at the scene for months in support for his family, including his disabled mother, who relied on her son for her care. The community even raised a £20,000 reward for information identifying the killer driver in 2022 after the investigation stalled. Yesterday, the public gallery was full of Mr. Whitehouse's friends and family who have been waiting 4 years for justice. The trial is due to last 5 days. Two pictures accompany this article. The first, captioned "Darren's mother and aunt pleaded for information about his death in a press conference." So it shows three people, a man and two women, sat at a desk with microphones on. The second picture is a close-up headshot captioned "Victim Darren Whitehouse," and it shows Darren wearing a cap looking straight into the camera. Loving pair enjoy special platinum day with family. An Albury couple have celebrated 70 years of wedding bliss. Tom and Joyce Campbell enjoyed a family meal to celebrate their platinum occasion at the weekend and to mark Joyce's birthday yesterday. The couple were married at St Patrick's Church, Birmingham on April 2, 1955, and honeymooned in London. After living in Barewood for a number of years, they moved to Albury, where they have remained ever since. The loving couple received a card from King Charles and Queen Camilla to mark their milestone and had a family meal to celebrate on Sunday. Their daughter, Catherine, said, "It is quite an achievement to be married for 70 years, and they deserve a special occasion." They were also thrilled to receive the card from Buckingham Palace, and the family were all delighted for them. A picture accompanies this article captioned "Tom and Joyce Campbell celebrated with a family meal to mark the milestone," and it's a close-up picture of Tom and Joyce, both wearing glasses, looking into the camera. Road is blocked following crash. A West Bromwich Road was blocked off to traffic following a crash. The collision took place on Hall Green Road in Stone Cross yesterday morning. West Midlands Roads, which is part of the Transport for West Midlands group, said the road was blocked. Writing to X, formerly Twitter, just after 10 a.m. it said, Hall Green Road Junction with A4031, Walsall Road, West Bromwich, Stone Cross, collision, road blocked. National Express West Midlands warned of diversions to its services as a result of the incident. Royal recognition given to devoted voluntary groups. A group for Halesowen, which has transformed the town into a welcoming and enjoyable place to be, were among the winners of the King's Award for Voluntary Service, KAVS. 19 community groups from across the West Midlands, including Halesowen in Bloom, attended the special celebration at the ICC in Birmingham on Sunday and collected their CAVS certificate from the Lord Lieutenant for the West Midlands, Derek Anderson, CBE. A CAVS honour is the only one given to groups of volunteers to recognise the significant contribution they make to their community, and the 19 organisations heard of their award on November 14 last year when it was announced as part of the King's Birthday Honours. Among the organisations are 4 from Dudley, 3 from Samwell, 2 covering the Black Country, 3 from Wolverhampton and 4 from Birmingham. In the Dudley Borough, winners included Access in Dudley, which helps people with disabilities to access buildings and services. Friends of Saltwells Nature Reserve. The volunteers not only conserve a site of national environmental importance, they also provide inclusive community activities. We Love Carers Charity. The organisation cares for carers and their families, creating a culture across Dudley of love and understanding. And Halesowen in Bloom. This is a vibrant community initiative that has transformed the town into a welcoming and enjoyable place to be. In Samwell, awards went to Worley Amateur Boxing Club. It has a long-standing tradition with dedicated volunteer coaches and members acting as a hub for boxing enthusiasts for almost 9 decades. Worley Woods Community Trust. Every year, more than 500,000 people enjoy the natural splendour of Worley Woods, 100 acres, thanks to a dedicated team of volunteers. And Wallace Youth Project. For almost 30 years, the group has evolved into a much-loved and valued resource, providing children, young people and their families with a sense of belonging, purpose and hope. In the wider region, winners were Black Country Mental Health, which provides much-needed social, mental health support and education services to the community, and the Black Country Blokes CIC, which supports the mental health of men in the Black Country through a weekly one-hour podcast, a weekly radio slot on Black Country Radio, daily boxing and fitness classes, and Thought for the Day on social media. In Wolverhampton, awards went to Friends of Di's Kitchen, established in 2020 in memory of Di Henry. It delivers weekly meals to anyone in need. Give Us a Break helps over 200 parents who have children with severe and complex disabilities. And Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust. With the NHS so stretched, it is heartwarming to hear how volunteers work with staff to support patients through a raft of help. 4 pictures accompany this article. The first, captioned Award Winners Dave Tyler and Sandra Vaughan from Black Country Mental Health with Dave Hill from Slade, shows the 3 of them stood smiling at the camera. The second picture, captioned the Halesowen in Bloom team at the award ceremony at the ICC in Birmingham, shows a group of 4 women and 4 men smiling at the camera. The third picture, captioned Friend of Di's Kitchen received their award, shows 1 woman and 2 men smiling at the camera whilst receiving their award. In the centre is Lord Lieutenant Derek Anderson, CBE. The fourth picture, captioned Barbara Platts from Worley Woods Trust, shows Barbara smiling at the camera, holding her certificate. Desolate Albion have got to pick themselves up for running. Article by Lewis Cox. Boss Tony Mowbray remains confident Albion can end their hunt for an elusive away win to fight back in the playoff race. The Baggies head to Bristol City's Ashton Gate tonight, looking to take back a place in the Championship's top six after the Robins snatched it from them over the weekend. City and Middlesbrough climbed above Mowbray's Albion and Coventry into 6th and 5th respectively. Liam Manning's host are enjoying an impressive run of form and have momentum with just one defeat in 9. Visitors Albion are hunting for some momentum, having gone winless in 4, including consecutive 1-0 defeats since the return from the international break. It is the first time the Baggies have fallen from the playoff places in 3 months at a time when games are running out, albeit Mowbray's side still have direct rivals to play, including Bristol City. Albion have struggled with inconsistency this term, particularly away from the Hawthorns. There has been just one victory in front of away supporters at Hull in November since September. That is a desperate sequence of one win in 18. Head coach Mowbray knows time is of the essence and that his troops need victories to make up the ground they have lost. The head coach described his side's dressing room as desolate after Saturday's 1-0 home defeat to Sunderland, but remained confident in what Albion can serve up on the road. Footballers are generally pretty emotional people, Mowbray said. Is desolate too hard a word? It's a desolate dressing room. A lot of heads are down. There are a lot of saturated shirts on the floor. You are trying to find the words to console them. I don't think it was a day to be shouting, blaming and pointing fingers. It's a day to stick together. There are games to play that we have to find a way to win. We have to win some away games now. I'm very confident we can. But we can't if we can't score a goal. I'm very confident we can go to Bristol City and dominate. Confident we can go to Coventry and Cardiff and dominate. There are difficult games. Derby are finding form under John Eustace, but we know how they will play. They will do what Blackburn did, with everybody behind the ball to make it really difficult. Can we score goals against those teams? We're going to have to find the answer and find it quickly. Mowbray's second reign, which is nearing 3 months, has included credible displays to drawing 1-1 at high-flying Leeds United and Burnley. Albion also drew by the same scoreline at Millwall, but have been beaten at Norwich, Plymouth and Middlesbrough. Albion could be stretched for their trip down the M5, with midfield star Isaac Price sidelined due to an ankle ligament damage, and a defensive concern given Torborn Haggam struggled off against the Black Cats last weekend. The Norwegian was seen leaving in a protective boot, having turned his ankle. 3 pictures accompany this article. The first 2 are next to each other and captioned, Torborn Haggam Wright injured his ankle on Saturday and is in doubt to face Bristol City. This picture shows the football players close up on the field playing. The second picture captioned, while boss Tony Mowbray believes his side can dominate tonight, shows Tony Mowbray shouting from the sidelines. The third picture is of the player starter positions. Wildsmith will start in goal, with Stiles, Diakite, Bartley and Furlong in defence, Grant, Mulby, Mowat and Fellows midfield, and Armstrong and Swift attacking. Substitutes are Griffiths, Fabrotta, Mohammed, Whitwell, Johnston, Diagana, Banny, Lancashire and Deke. Bristol City 3-4-3 with O'Leary, Pring, Dickey, Viner, Sykes, Williams, Knight, McCrory, Bird, Wells and Earthy. And the big match prediction is a home win.
Albion match report. Trey Hume hit the winning goal for the second consecutive game as Sunderland kept alive their slim hopes of automatic promotion from the Championship with a resolute victory against playoff-chasing West Bromwich Albion. A strong Baggy start in glorious sunshine at the Hawthorns had the Black Cats on the back foot. Only for defender Hume's venomous in-swinging 35th-minute free kick to beat ill-prepared keeper Joel Wildsmith for pace. The hosts, who have now not won in four games and remain outside the top six by 2 points, continue to have the bulk of possession, with Mikey Johnston and Grady Diangana particularly threatening. But they were too often wayward in front of goal and sloppy with their final pass. Jason Malumbi missed their best chance, somehow heading over from a well-worked short corner just before the interval, while Darnell Furlong also had a shot cleared off the line by outstanding Chris Metham. Sunderland, in fourth and 8 points off the top two, continued to keep the Baggies at arm's length on the resumption, with the host ending with 21 attempts on goal, but just three on target. Their ninth away league win of the season was based on a masterful defensive display, epitomised by Metham, who made several superb blocks and tackles, including the vital goal line clearance to deny Furlong. Luke O'Neill was equally influential, while Hume's quality also showed at the other end. His powerful free kick flying past a bemused Wildsmith for the game's telling moment. The Baggies could easily have been ahead before Hume followed up his winning goal against Millwall last week, but as well as Furlong's nearly moment, Johnston had a shot blocked as Albion wasted several promising situations. But despite Johnston remaining a likely source of a goal, Tony Mowbray's side created very little after the resumption and stayed in seventh spot after a fifth game in a row without a win against Sunderland. Tony Mowbray said, "Joe acknowledged that he made a pretty bad mistake which cost us a goal and ultimately the game. But that's the job as a goalkeeper. It's frustrating because that becomes the narrative. With the chances we had and the situations we got into, you have to put the ball in the net. We've been here before, but I'll see what he's like in training and see how he reacts. It's very naive to think the goalie makes a mistake, so change the goalie. If the goalie you put in makes a mistake in the next game, where do you go then? Change him again? I don't think so. I will rely on my experience to make the right decisions. But the responsibility of the team is to score some goals in a game we were on top of for most of it."
Baggies fans, welcome to the latest episode of the Baggies broadcast, brought to you by the Express and Star and sponsored by West Midlands Metro. Oh, just when you think the Albion cannot let you down anymore, they go and do it all over again. My name is Johnny Drury. I'm in the passenger seat. Lewis Cox is in the driver's seat. We're bringing you an on-the-road Baggies broadcast as we travel back from another midweek disappointment, shocker, you call it what you want, late heartbreak at Bristol City as Albion's bad form continued. Third defeat on the bounce.
Albion match report. Hayden Roberts scored a 96-minute winner for Bristol City as they moved up to fifth in the Championship with a 2-1 win against playoff rivals West Brom at Ashton Gate. Naki Wells gave the Robins the lead early in the second half with a rocket of a shot from the edge of the area into the bottom right corner. Alex Mowat equalised for the Baggies 6 minutes later, pouncing on a mishap between City keeper Max O'Leary and Cameron Pring for an easy shot into an empty net behind them. The Baggies then saw Jason Malumbi sent off for a late challenge on Joe Williams in the 89th minute, and substitute Roberts clinched the winner with less than 90 seconds left on the clock in extra time. Bristol City moved 6 points clear of their opponents and above Middlesbrough, who lost to Leeds, while holding a 4-point advantage on Coventry City in seventh, who face Portsmouth on Wednesday. The win extends Bristol City's remarkable run at home with only one defeat in their past 13 matches at Ashton Gate, form that has helped them surge up the table through 2025.
Defeat for West Brom is their third consecutive loss and leaves them without a win in their past five matches. Baggies boss Tony Mowbray made a big call before kick-off, choosing to select Josh Griffiths in goal for his first championship start in 2 years, ahead of Joe Wildsmith after he made another error during their loss against Sunderland at the weekend. If the 23-year-old who spent the first half of the season with Blue Side of Bristol at League One Bristol Rovers had any nerves given the weight of the match, he did not show it, making two excellent first-half saves to deny the hosts taking the lead. Mark Sykes pounced on a loose ball on the edge of the box, catching the Baggies napping, but Griffith's diving one-hand save denied the Republic of Ireland international and then also Wells on the rebound. He then parried away another effort after Wells broke down the right and crossed into the box, where the ball was met by George Earthy, who could not get his first-time effort past the Baggies stopper. West Brom had a couple of half chances of their own at the other end, with Isaac Price seeing a shot from the centre of the box go high and wide of the target, while Kyle Bartley saw a header comfortably into the arms of O'Leary. Griffiths could do nothing about Wells's effort, however, when the Robins took the lead early in the second half. The 34-year-old, who has scored three in his past four games, shrugged off his defender on the edge of the 18-yard box before unleashing a shot into the bottom corner that Griffiths could get nowhere near. Ashton Gate was temporarily bouncing before being stunned minutes later when O'Leary came off his line to jump up for a high ball, clattered into Pring, and the ball rolled loose right into the path of Mowat, who had the easiest of taps into the empty net in front of a raucous Baggies away end. West Brom had their tails up after the goal and piled on the pressure with Ousmane Diakite's downward header, their best effort, forcing O'Leary to dive to the corner to save it. Diakite then saw another shot saved with 5 minutes on the clock before Daryl DK sent an effort high over the crossbar. Malumbi's red card proved the turning point for a reckless challenge on Williams right in front of the referee, who reached immediately into his pocket. The Robins camped out in West Brom's box for the entirety of added time, and with seconds remaining, Rob Dickey picked out Roberts in the box and he drilled a shot through the legs of the unfortunate Griffiths into the net for the winner. Tony Mowbray said, "I can't keep repeating the same things. We have to find a way. I've just vented a bit of frustration. I feel as if it can't happen. They can't score in the 96th minute. Even though we're a man down, we've still got 9 outfield players in that box. Somebody has to block it. Somebody has to get their body there. It's a frustration because I think if anybody was going to win it before the sending off, it was us. We were in the ascendancy. Their crowd had gone quiet. We were dominating the ball. We had an amazing chance to score and win it with a couple of them in the last 15 minutes, and to lose it. Is cruel the right word? It seems ridiculous to me, but we have, and we have to accept it and move on."
Yes, let's hope things get better for Mowbray and the team. And you can hear the Baggies podcast every week or two if you've got facilities to listen to podcasts. And I hope we might get permission to use some of their podcasts in the future. Now, before we leave on this edition, something I couldn't squeeze into last week's edition, the ongoing anxiety and discussion about the PIPS reforms. It's not going away anytime soon. In fact, we'll be hearing much more about this over the next year or more. But here's a piece that came into us from The Independent just over a week ago. and thought you might find it interesting.
This is an article that was in The Independent, and it's been sent to us from the Sandwell Talking News' secretary, Derek Fletcher, who thought it might be of interest. Blind people set to lose thousands in benefits still cannot read details of Labour's welfare reform plans. The Department for Work and Pensions has promised that audio versions for blind people, Braille and other accessible forms will be ready in early April, but with the consultation underway, there is fury that they were not available from the start. Lib Dem MP Steve Darling, who is registered blind and uncovered the delay, hit back saying it was nothing short of a disgrace. James Taylor, Executive Director of Strategy at disability equality charity Scope, said, "This is one of the many, many things which are wrong about these catastrophic proposals. These are some of the biggest cuts to disability benefits on record. Yet, nearly 2 weeks after they were published, disabled people who are facing thousands of pounds a year in support being ripped away still aren't able to read the full plans. The government needs to rethink these proposals and start listening to and working with disabled people." The row erupted as a result of a parliamentary question by Mr. Darling, who is Lib Dem Work and Pensions spokesperson, answered by Welfare Minister Stephen Timms, who said accessible versions will be published, quote, "in due course," unquote. The minister went on to say that, "We have published this green paper ahead of all accessible versions to put detailed information about the matters subject to consultation in the public domain at the earliest opportunity. The government has also failed to produce accessible versions of the subsequent impact assessment." Mr. Darling said, "I have experienced firsthand just how difficult things can be for someone who is visually impaired in this system, trying to navigate the maze of paperwork and information that needs to be understood. For the government to now put forward these major changes in a way that many can't even access is nothing short of a disgrace. Disabled people have taken the brunt of the cuts, largely through a reworking of the criteria for personal independence payments, PIPs, which is meant to ensure only those with severe disabilities will qualify. Disabled people have taken the brunt of the cuts, largely through a reworking of the criteria for personal independence payments, PIPs, which is meant to ensure only those with severe disabilities will qualify. The government's impact assessment suggested that 250,000 people, including 50,000 children, will be plunged into poverty as a result of the changes. Some of those are among the 340,000 people registered blind or partially sighted in the UK who cannot read the details of the documents yet. The Lib Dems have claimed the delay could put the government at risk of breaking their own regulations on accessibility. Part of the requirements for accessibility in public bodies are that you must make your website or mobile app more accessible by making it perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust. You need to include and update an accessibility statement on your website. They go on to say, you may be breaking the law if your public sector website or mobile app does not meet accessibility requirements. Accessible versions of documents can include large print, font size 16 or greater, Braille, printed tactile documents, audio, MP3, DAISY, audio only, audio description for multimedia, electronic, Microsoft Word or other processor files, PDF, DAISY, audio and text, HTML and closed captioned for multimedia. The row also follows Chief Treasury Secretary Darren Jones's quip, claiming removing benefits was like removing pocket money, for which he has apologised. Mr. Darling said, first they compared removing vital support to taking away a child's pocket money, and now they won't even give those potentially affected the dignity of going through the details as to how much they will lose out by. This government has fallen in real danger of losing its moral compass. Ministers need to immediately publish the accessible versions of their green paper and impact assessment. A DWP spokesperson said, "We have set out a sweeping package of reforms to health and disability benefits that genuinely support people back into work while putting the welfare system on a more sustainable footing so that the safety net is always there to protect those who need it most."
News and information from Sandwell Council. Preserving the past in Wensbury as historic horse troughs move to new home. As work to improve Wensbury Town Centre continues, the town's history is also being preserved. Two historic stone horse troughs, previously located on the corner of High Street and Upper High Street, have been moved to near the bandstand in Brunswick Park, Wensbury. Alderman John Handley and his sister Miss Jane Handley gifted the horse troughs to the residents of Wensbury in May 1910 and September 1906, respectively. Alderman Handley served as Mayor of Wensbury from 1906 until 1908, and he and his sister also gifted the land to build Wensbury Library. Wensbury Town Centre is currently benefiting from Levelling Up Partnership, LUP, investment from the government. Work has already been completed to help keep Wensbury safe by installing new and upgraded CCTV cameras and agreeing a master plan for Wensbury Town Centre, which forms a vision for the town. Find out more about Wensbury LUP on the Regenerating Sandwell website. These improvements also include preserving Wensbury's past with the help of the council's contractor, McPhillips, who are currently carrying out works in Union Street. These include replacing street paving, planting trees, and installing new street furniture. Sandwell Council's Cabinet Member for Regeneration and Infrastructure, Councillor Peter Hughes, said, "We want to thank McPhillips for their hard work and dedication on these renovations for Wensbury. The improvements to public spaces will provide everyone with a pleasant place to live, work and shop. Wensbury residents are rightly proud of their town's history. These stone troughs are a small part of that history, but each piece we save helps to preserve the full history of Wensbury for future generations to study. And they will also add to the beauty of Brunswick Park. An official unveiling event involving descendants of the Handley family is due to take place in the near future." Contractors McPhillips moved and installed the troughs in Brunswick Park for free, helping to keep them safe and accessible for people to see for the future. Friends of Brunswick Park, Jill Turner and Stephen Robinson, joined Dan Redmond from McPhillips and Alan Wheatley from Sandwell Council's grounds maintenance team when the troughs were installed at the park. Dan Redmond said, "At McPhillips, we deeply value the communities where we operate and we understand the importance of preserving local history. The relocation of the historic horse troughs to Brunswick Park is a wonderful opportunity to celebrate the town's heritage while enhancing the town's communal space. By moving these planters, which have been part of the community for over 100 years, to the bandstand, we are not just preserving history, but are also improving the park space for residents to enjoy for years to come." Apartments refurbished and new homes provided in Wensbury, Thorn Close front elevation. Council homes in a Wensbury neighbourhood have undergone a major refurbishment with two new apartments also created to help provide much needed housing. Sandwell Council and its contractor, SWG Construction, have completed the refurbishment and new build project in Thorn Close, Wensbury. SWG has revitalised 12 one-bedroomed and 16 three-bedroomed two-storey apartments, while also adding two brand-new one-bedroomed single-storey apartments within the original underused underpasses. The project not only improves the quality of housing for residents, but also enhances the surrounding environment with new landscaping, garden, roofs, modernised communal spaces and upgraded facilities. Alongside the new apartments, SWG completed essential works, including a new steel frame pitched roof, replacement windows and doors, a new facade, updated staircases and balconies. The scheme was designed by Sandwell Council's Urban Design Building Services. In addition, a local resident from Thorn Close, who was previously not in education, employment or training, was given the chance to work on the project, offering him a valuable opportunity to gain skills and work experience close to her home. As part of their community commitment, SWG also contributed to the local area by donating painting materials and labour to St Mary's Church Hall and improving the Thorn Close compound area with new turfing. The company also held fundraising coffee mornings at their offices in Wolverhampton and Welshpool to support Heart Care Healthy Living, a charity dedicated to helping communities in Walsall, Sutton Coldfield and surrounding areas to manage heart and lung health issues.
Just time for me to give a round of thanks to this week's readers: James, Debbie, Lauren, Sargit, Jenny and Robert. And I'm not sure how much we'll hear from Robert and Becky, because I hear Becky's expecting a baby sometime soon. But I hope we'll continue to hear from them. Wish them all the best. And thank you very much to them. And to Linda from Rowley Regis, doing the football results, as depressing as they are. And the news from Wednesbury, as it turned out to be this week, from the Sandwell Press Office. Thanks also, of course, go to Sue Clovier for choosing all the items from the papers, and Pam for coordinating it all on the internet for our readers. And last but no means least, Tony and Gavin doing the distribution at the Town Hall, where we'll be meeting in a few weeks' time. I'm sorry we won't be with you for the next two or three weeks, but I'm afraid, Easter and the bank holidays being what they are, we have to take a break. But I hope the weather persists in being spring-like, which it has been for the past few days, and hope you get out and enjoy it. I certainly am. That's it then for this week and for this month from the Sandwell Talking News. We'll be back with you in early May. In the meantime, take care, and we'll be back with you on May the 3rd. Bye-bye from me, Ray, and all the team.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.